The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And at least we know that Italy will be tired. And so will I. Do the players not realise how late we are forced to record these things when it goes the distance? At the end of it all, the Azzurri are through to the final of Euro 2020 on penalties after a pulsating game of football. The hop and skip of Jorginho takes them through. Olmo and Morata, both brilliant on the night, miss their spot kicks. It's a cruel game. Before that, breathless stuff. Busquets pulling the strings. Olmo everywhere. Pedri, he is 18. 18 and playing like that. The grizzled husks of Chiellini and Bonucci going to the end. The second semi-final, if you don't know, is between England and Denmark. We'll do some idle speculation on that. If we have time and inclination, we'll discuss Arsene Wenger wanting a World Cup every 2 years. Guess we can do it just after the Euros. One team qualifies. You've asked some questions. One of you empathises with Barry in a Munich kind of way. And by the time we get there, that will certainly be enough of today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome. Do you want to unmute yourself? Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Yes, hello, I got there in the end.
Excellent news. It is late, after all.
I'm sure there are many people out there who would prefer me to stay muted.
Absolutely not.
For the duration.
You're an integral part. Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Hi.
Are you okay?
Yeah, sorry, I was just looking something up, and for some reason I seemed to be coming to May 3rd, and so I was taken slightly by surprise. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Look, I'm sorry for bothering you. Let me know if I'm allowed to for the rest of the pod. Philippe, with Barry on mute and Wilson monosyllabic, a lot of heavy lifting on the pod for you tonight.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I am really good. Thanks for asking, Philippe. First of all, let's go to Nicky Baldini, who's at Wembley. Ostensibly working, but also, I guess, as a fan. How are you, Nicky?
I'm working, but I've been very lucky tonight. I've been given the gig of not having to write on the whistle. I'm writing something tomorrow morning, so working in a way that allowed my nerves to survive the evening, frankly. But yeah, it's an amazing feeling. It's been a very, very anxious evening, but I thought it was a fantastic game of football. I thought Spain absolutely deserved to go through to the final. I thought they played best in Italy for most of the game, but I thought both teams played it, especially at the start, at such a high tempo and with such a commitment to playing out from the back. I thought the way Italy were trying at least to break the press was really quick, one-touch football, was very ambitious, which was really made for such an enjoyable game of football. But I mean, Pedri, Olmo, there were some fantastic performances from Spain, and I don't think they deserve to lose.
The noise is great there. What was the atmosphere like?
It was amazing, to be honest with you. I think even though I was here for the Austria game in the last 16, you forget what it feels like to be in a stadium with this many fans in. I don't actually know what the attendance was tonight, but I think it was closer to 60,000. And that's a big difference from 20,000, 30,000 people. It's really so loud. And right from the beginning with the anthems, so loud. Right from the first minute of the game when Spain got the ball, and you just felt this wave of whistles come down from the Italian end. And there really was an Italian end and a Spanish end. And I haven't felt that inside a football stadium in so long. I haven't felt that thrill, that buzz of just what it's like when you've got that many people expressing it as I guess immediately, with that immediacy that happens in a football stadium. It was a thrill.
What's it like to see your team win a penalty shootout in a semi-final?
Brilliant at the end, awful in the process. When Locatelli missed that first one, I was absolutely in bits, to be honest with you, although there was something. There felt like something fated to me as Olmo walked up. I thought, he's not going to score. He's just having that tournament. He's not going to score his penalty. And so once Olmo had missed, it became a bit more relaxing. I have to say, Donnarumma is one of those goalkeepers who you look at in a penalty shootout and you think, you know what, we're going to be okay, because he's just so big in that goal. He's such a presence. But yeah, it was nerve-wracking. And when the last one went in, honestly, such a noise here. I haven't been inside a stadium with a noise like that in a really, really long time.
It's funny to think Jorginho probably knew who was going through about half an hour before the rest of us.
Jorginho is brilliant. I think he's at this point got to be in the running for the Ballon d'Or this season, having gone with Chelsea to win the Champions League and now going to the final of the Euros is really the one constant in this team. I mean, you think that by the time this game ended, it felt like it was a completely different Italy team on the pitch. Mancini's there rolling on his second line like it's an ice hockey game. He's bringing in his whole second line of players to play the game. But Jorginho is just the one out, other than Donnarumma in goal, he's the one who just does not get a rest ever. And look, you can see why.
I think you're probably right that Spain were better on the night. But do you feel that Italy probably deserved to be in the final and what they've done this tournament?
A thought came into my head just right after this game ended, which is that at Euro 2008, Spain began something, but they began something by beating Italy on penalties that tournament. Spain went on to win Euro 2008, they went on to go and win the World Cup, they went on to go and win Euro 2012, but they still had this difficult, awkward game against Italy that had to get won in a penalty shootout. Now, look, Italy have not won anything yet, so who knows if they'll go on to do any of that. But I think when you're starting something new, when you're at the beginning of a journey, which they clearly are under Mancini, you can't expect to have it all your own way and get every game go your way. I thought Mancini was out-coached by Enrique today, but sometimes you just need to get those breaks in a big game and see where it leads.
Who would you rather in the final?
Look, honestly, I'm half English and half Italian, so of course it would be amazing for me to have both sides of my family represented in the final. Also, as I did say on a previous podcast, I placed two bets at this tournament. They were Italy and England to win the whole thing, so it'll be looking good for my bank balance if they both get to the final as well.
Well, I'll let you just enjoy the celebrations, and thanks for coming on, Nicky. Appreciate it.
No problems. Thanks. So. See you guys soon.
Nicky Bandini there at Wembley. And I thought, Barry, she summed it up well, that Spain probably deserved that, but Italy won it, and it was a brilliant game of football.
It was a brilliant game of football. I'd definitely go with that. Did Spain deserve to win? I'm not sure. I suppose it depends on what your view of deserving to win is. And there are many different sides of the argument. Either Spain played very well, but it's a problem they have had at times during the tournament where they struggled to score, missed lots of easy chances, dropped Alvaro Morata to start with. You know, he's already failed, had his redemption, was dropped, so his redemption was gone again. They failed to score without him. They played, I think, three wingers up front, no striker. Brought him on. He scored, and the commentator said, redemption for Morata, and then he missed his penalty, which means he leaves, by my reckoning, thoroughly unredeemed once again, and no doubt in line for a load of stick on social media, which is how he kind of started the tournament. So I would argue Spain played very well, had loads of chances to win it, didn't put them away, so you could argue they didn't deserve to win. I thought Italy played pretty well as well, and I fancied them when it went to penalties. But it's easy to say that after the event, but I did fancy them.
Richard said this was like watching Leeds play Leeds. Wilson, it was it was a great game, wasn't it, Jonathan?
It was a really good game, yeah. I mean, I think maybe the best game in the new Wembley. I mean, I struggle to think of a better one. Definitely the best game of the tournament. Thoroughly engaging. And I was surprised by how difficult Italy found it. You know, the whole story of this tournament for them has been how they're playing a more progressive form of football, that they're trying to impose themselves on opponents. And yet tonight they only had 34% of the ball. And I guess we know Spain are good in possession. But I thought they did have a cutting edge tonight. It was just... Yasabal missed that header just after Italy had taken the lead. There's a couple of other decent chances. Donovan made that one good save from Olmo in the first. I mean, Olmo was brilliant, apart from the missed penalty. But the inevitability of Morata missing that penalty. This is face said, I'm going to miss this. All history said he was going to miss it. I know people don't like sort of the imposition of narrative on events, but they really should have a narrative consultant there on the bench going, no, no, not him. Anybody but him.
Have you? You see, there's one person with a tactics board and one person with like the narrative board. You know, the guy with the amazing thick frames and little beard in the Italian team. We'll get to who he is in a second, but he should have the narrative board going, now this is not what you need at this moment. You're on set pieces. This is who you're marking at corners, and this absolutely is who shouldn't be taking your final penalty.
So yeah, so Gareth Southgate should have named himself in the 26, so he could come off a bench to take the winning penalty tomorrow night, because that would be the narratively appropriate thing to happen.
I keep reading long articles in The Athletic about various people who are integral to Gareth Southgate's backroom staff. Apparently the guys who took out the unicorn inflatables and put them in the pool, like, chose that exact time after that game to put them in the pool. And this is again going to be a huge, very important step in England's path to victory.
Should they be in the 26 to take a penalty as well? The
no,
unicorn inflator.
They're in charge of aquatic inflatables, and that's a very separate job, Max, to taking penalties. I no doubt one will be written at some point about how Southgate had a narrative guy on the bench to be in charge of that kind of thing.
How did you view the narrative of this game, Philippe?
How did I view it? With surprise, Max, because I think that I wasn't expecting Spain to be as aggressive as they were in pressing the ball. I wasn't expecting the effect that this would have on Italy, as in they seemed to hurry a lot of their moves throughout the game. Yes, surprise and delight. And by the way, I just regret that this is just a podcast. There is no image, because I still wonder how Nikki was able to speak through that smile of hers, which she had, which is absolutely wonderful to see. I was trying to think, has there been, I mean, it's a bit like, it's on the level of France-Portugal 84, I think, in terms of the great semi-finals in this tournament. It really is. And I think that it will take some time to sink in, because we've barely caught our breath. You know, we're just talking after the final whistle.
Can you remind younger listeners about, you know, about that game in 84?
It went to extra time as well, and France had gone behind, and at the very last minute of extra time, Jean Tigana got the ball, somehow slalomed past three Portuguese midfielders, defenders, whatever, and crossed the ball, and who was there but Michel Platini to slot it in, and to have France to qualify France for its first ever major final. And it felt, yeah, it was that kind of intensity, and with the same kind of atmosphere as well. It was, I mean, even though we were watching this on television, I think everybody felt this extraordinary fervor from the crowd, which was honestly very moving, I thought.
Wilson, I didn't know what game to expect, but for some, I just presumed it would be tight, and I presumed it wouldn't be the kind, I mean, it wasn't like a basketball game, but it felt in moments like it was, you know, it felt like both teams moved the ball much quicker than I was perhaps anticipating.
Well, we mentioned this last time I was on, and Nikki referred to it there as well, this idea of Spain and Italy representing different facets of the game. And that game in 2008 being a sort of real shift in Spain's favour. And obviously that began to change in 2016 when Conte's Italy beat Spain. But then Spain beat them in World Cup qualifying as Italy failed to qualify. I think they drew in Italy and it was 3-0 in Spain. But it's as if they've sort of met in the middle. That this isn't just Spain passing the ball forever. There is a directness and there is a purpose to it. And so purpose may be the wrong word, because I think the purpose sort of around 2010, 2012 was to wear down the opposition. But it is a bit more, there is more verticality, to use the word that Luis Enrique loves. And Italy, who I think we're used to, you know, sitting deep playing on the break, well, they sort of did that tonight, but they are comfortable on the ball, and they are happy to play on the front foot, and they are happy to dominate possession when they're able to. So it's as if these two separate schools of football have come together in some kind of synthesis. And the result was an amazing game.
The Chiesa goal was a wonderful finish, Barry, wasn't it? The thing I loved about it most was when Donnarumma rolled it out, he sort of chased it like a curler chases, you know, chases after their ice block thing or whatever it is.
Stone,
that's the thing. It's not an ice block, is it? That really wouldn't. That's a rolling ice on
ice. I was rather hoping he'd get a little sweeping brush out from his goal net and start, you know, scrubbing frantically the grass in front of the stone. But great counter attack goal. The what was it? Verratti out wide and Laporte tackle at the edge of the area, ball breaks to Chiesa, and an absolutely beautiful finish. Just a wonderful goal. He's a terrific player, and it was a wonderful goal.
Surely the great thing about that, the finish, though, was how quickly he shifted the ball. Yeah, the little side step to get beyond the defender, and then he hits it immediately.
Was the defender at fault for showing him onto his right foot?
Yeah, I wondered about that. But it just happened so quickly that I don't know. I think there comes a point which he's going to say he's done that really fast.
Someone on BBC said in their analysis of the goal, oh, you've got to know which foot each player, you know, is his strong foot. And I was just thinking, like, it's quite, in the heat of battle, you look up and you see, who's that? Oh, God, what foot is that? You desperately try to, left or right? I can't remember. And next thing, the ball is nestling in the back of the net.
The latest in a long list of why Barry is not an elite centre-back.
But I can't even remember, you know, it takes me time to figure out which is my left and right foot. Never mind someone else's.
Speaking of quick feet, there was a bit, something that Ferran Torres did that was sort of quite extraordinary, Philippe, which was,
yes,
it was sort of a drag back, and then I'm not sure I don't know how to describe it. It was an amazing piece of skill.
Yes, I mean, it's between what we'd call a double contact in French, where you switch very quickly from one foot to the next. But his had almost a balletic quality, because there was such a fluidity in the way that he transferred the ball to the proper side in one movement. Before I forget it, because it's very late, can we just say that there was one player who exceeded all expectations tonight because he had huge boots to fill? It's Emerson. Because everybody thought that Spinazzola's absence, because of his, you know, his terrible injury, would mean that this Italian team would be far less threatening on the left-hand side. Actually, would you know, because they play almost with a 3-3-4 from time to time, when Spinazzola is in the side. And I thought Emerson was absolutely magnificent, honestly. I don't know if you shared my impression. I thought he was very trenchant in his interventions. He was constantly trying to look forward, perhaps not overdoing it, but perhaps taking a role, going further in that direction that he would normally do. And for a player who's barely played all year, can you imagine? It's your first proper game of the season, really. It's a semi-final of a European Championship. You're replacing one of the players of the tournament, and you come out of it with, I think, a lot of credit to your name. I think so. Chapeau, Emerson.
Chapeau, Emerson. Morata's equaliser. Again, Barry, that was a wonderful move, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, I suppose that's why he's so frustrating, because he scores some amazing goals and then misses some awful sitters. And I don't know if it's because his reputation goes before him or he's just far more frustrating than other good strikers. But the give and go with Dani Olmo and the slotting past Donnarumma, it was a great finish. And as the commentator said, redemption for Morata, briefly.
I didn't want to ask you, Barry, about Busquets and Jorginho, because it's holding midfielders. You clearly didn't notice them on the pitch at all. But they were both... Well, I mean, everyone said Busquets ran this game, Wilson. I wonder what you thought.
Yeah. It's something I can't... I just don't really understand how he can look so out of sorts playing for Barcelona in big games, you know, in Champions League games. You know, in those matches, his lack of pace, I know he's never been quick, but his even more profound lack of pace seems such a liability for them. And then you see him in the midfield with Koke and Pedri, and I guess he plays with Pedri regularly, but Koke and just a better organisation of that midfield maybe than what he's had at Barcelona. And he suddenly looks the player he was 10 years ago again. So he had a great night.
And Pedri completed his pass completion rate in 90 minutes was 100%.
Well, that was what I was looking up when you so rudely kind of said hello to me earlier on. I was looking if he maintained 100%. He didn't. It was 97% by the end.
This was what was interesting about this game was I did think Spain were the better side, but I thought it was tight. But when I tried to think about Italy players who were brilliant, and you mentioned Emerson, I thought he did play well. I sort of struggled to think of how many of their players who really stood out for me. Maybe that's a sign that they are, you know, more than a sum of their parts, or they were just consistently sort of solid today.
But there is a conviction, though, running through the whole side. There is a togetherness in that side which is quite remarkable. And if you talk about narratives, that's probably one narrative you're going to take, is that they're on this mission of remaining undefeated forever. How many games is that now? 38?
33.
You just need one man holding a sign saying, narrative. Forever unbeaten. It's quite an easy one for the players to follow. No wonder you need so many people on the bench telling everybody what to do. That man, by the way, who we have discussed, James says, who is the chap on the Italian coaching team with the comedy glasses and moustache? He looks like a Geraldo Rivera tribute act. His name is Alberico Evani. 15 caps for Italy. He's been part of the Italy sort of managerial setup from under-18s upwards since 2010. So that is who that man is with the very thick-rimmed specs.
He also has 3 Serie A medals, 2 European Cups, and he had the honour of playing for Italy when Ireland beat them at USA 94.
All right. Good information.
And if you look him up, he was a very handsome man.
He was, wasn't he, a dish?
Very handsome
great.
Man.
He looks great now, but really.
And is now apparently the subject of mockery from people who have achieved far less than he has.
The tiny car was back, which was wonderful news for everybody. It even has its own Twitter account now. Of course, it does. Everything does. At Tiny Football Car. I tweeted out, you know, that its first game was in Rome, and it's obviously taken this. It's been driving from Rome to here, the tiny car, and that's why we haven't seen it all this time.
Has there been a long read in The Athletic about the guy who is guiding the car yet?
Well, most certainly. Adam Wright says, 1,181 miles from Rome to Wembley, 25 days since the opener. It's done an average of 47.24 miles a day, touched under 2 miles an hour all the way. It's probably about right. So that's what happened. Alex said, I just saw a Spanish player with Eric on his back. My brain assumed this was Laporte. After all the I'm Eric Laporte content you've delivered. I was taken by surprise when he turned round and it was Eric Garcia. If they get to the final, they should swap shirts. Give the people what they want. And Jim says, am I alone in thinking that Mancini and Enrique's outfits tonight make them look like they could be in a team rom-com as the dads from opposite ends of the tracks? Who battle to keep their kids apart, but ultimately realise they have more in common and young love wins out.
He was looking very Rufus Sewell tonight, wasn't he, Luis Enrique?
He really was. He was at his most Rufus Sewell, that's for sure. I do enjoy how people watch these games and the things that they think about. Is there anything anybody feels they need to add from this football match? We've moved away from the game itself. Does anyone have any pressing thoughts on what happened?
I would have quite liked when the car came on with the ball. It went very sort of veered around the legs of one of the Italian players who was just outside the centre circle waiting for kickoff. I'd have quite liked if he'd gone down holding his calf just as a sign of things to come later in the game. But on a slightly more serious note, I think that Morata scored just in time for Spain because I think it was the 79th, 80th minute, and about time Italy would have been getting down to some serious time-wasting shithousery that it would have disrupted the game. I wonder if perhaps they may have taken all the mockery and criticism they got in the last game on board and perhaps not made a semi-conscious decision not to engage in that kind of carry-on. And it possibly cost them.
Yeah, it was there was definitely less of it in that small, you know, that moment between scoring and conceding the equaliser.
Well, and also Felix Bick, the referee, is a doctor, so he presumably is in a better place than most to say, "Get up, son, you play acting." Well,
that's diabetes, you know. Like, yeah. That's an instant diagnosis. That's it. That's great.
He makes them all fill out a form before the game, and they have to say how much they drink each week, and they all lie.
They all write 14 units. 14 units.
I mean, is there any reason that particularly comes to mind, Barry?
Well, it's what everyone does. You figure out how many units a week you drink, you divide it by four, and that's what you put down. And it's still too much.
Philippe, who wins the Euros, Italy or one of the others?
Oh, my God, what a question. I think there is something about this Italian side that, again, there seems to be a sense of history and fate behind them. A fair wind blowing in the sail of Gucci Mancini. That's the way I feel it. And by the way, maybe this one, I don't know if you noticed that during the anthems, did you remark the difference in attitude of the players from both the Spanish and the Italians? Well, of course, the Spanish cannot sing to an anthem which hasn't got any lyrics, or rather whose lyrics have been forgotten because they are linked to a certain part of their past. But they looked extraordinarily focused to the point that they looked tense. The Italians, you know, at the image of Giorgio Chiellini, who is honestly has got the most relaxed attitude to big games that of any player I've ever seen.
It's mad, isn't
it's
it?
It's mad. It's absolutely mad. And also, I mean, this fabulous scene, we've got to mention it, when they were tossing the coin for the penalty. Yeah. I mean, come on. Who would you ever see that? And then taking, is it Thiago Alcantara was with them in the center circle?
Jordi Alba.
Jordi Alba in center circle and raising him in his arms. As a long-lost son, and laughing in his face and giving him a kiss. That's beautiful. That's where I see the sign of a true winner, Max.
Yeah, in my role as narrative consultant, if I can just drag on my my storyboard, Chiellini played in the first ever game at the new Wembley in the 3-3 draw between England, Italy, under-21s.
Is that the new Wembley or the old Wembley? When was Chiellini playing under-21s?
Yeah, he played in an exhibition game before the White Horse final in 1923.
And that'll do. Part two and three will be short because it's 11:30 at night. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. There is a live event on Friday with Johnny Lou and Barney Ronnie looking ahead to the final of Euro 2020. It is for digital subscribers. So if you are one of them, just go on to wherever you go if you're a digital subscriber, the app, I presume, and you'll get all the details. Go and see them chat Friday lunchtime, where they will be talking about the final between Italy and one of England or Denmark. Tristan says, what has Barry got planned for tomorrow evening? Dinner, cinema, what?
I believe, Max, I've been shanghaied into going to Rushden Towers for the evening to watch England-Denmark. I've never been in Rushden Towers before. I don't know where your address. I was looking forward to the current Mrs. Rushden serving snacks and drinks. I hear she's been drummed out for the evening.
No, she's going to a hotel. She didn't want to be any part of it.
Okay, so I'll be honest, I don't want to go to your house to watch the game, but apparently I don't have a choice.
Why not?
If England win, I'll be in your company. If England lose, I'll be in your company. And then once we're finished recording the pod, I'll have to run the public transport gauntlet with a load of very happy / angry England fans, tick as applicable, neither of which I'm particularly enthused about doing.
Do you want to stay in the spare room?
No.
Okay. Jonathan, you wrote an article in the paper about the key tactical decisions facing Gareth Southgate. Can you just sort of, nobody wants to read all of it. Can you just tell it to us?
I haven't read it. Can I guess what they are?
Well, I think it was four points.
Four points. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Barry and Philippe guess the 4 points of Jonathan Wilson's tactical masterclass on England versus Denmark from an English perspective. Barry, guess one.
So this is, what does Gareth Southgate need to do? Is this roughly what it is?
I suppose so, yeah.
He needs to decide whether to go with a back three or a back four.
That's the crux of it. That's the main bit. I'm now going to look it up because I genuinely can't remember all the other three.
If he decides to go with a back three, then he has to make a decision about what to do with Mason Mount. Does he play him as part of the front three or does he leave him out? I'm going to say, does he pick Grealish or Phil Foden? No, he doesn't. If, no matter what formation he goes with.
That's sort of 2 points he's kind of generally covered. So there's, is it a three or is it four at the back? And then who plays on the right of the front three, whether it's a 3-4-3 or a 4-3-3. So that's two of the points.
Okay. Could it have to be with the fact that England pressed much higher and much more intensely against Ukraine, and whether it is worth and a good idea to do the same against a team like Denmark, which is much more sprightly and imaginative in the way that it transfers the ball from line to line?
Well, that was sort of covered in the thing on whether it should be a back three or a back four. So the other 2 points were that the games last year, with, you know, the 0-0 in Copenhagen and the 1-0 to Denmark at Wembley, probably aren't that relevant because there's a good chance that the two teams will play the opposite formations. So whereas Denmark played a 4-3-3 then, I think England could play a 4-3-3 here. England played a back three then. I think Denmark will play a back three tomorrow. And then the other one was making the point that England really prospered against Ukraine in the air, and the Danes are big, and so that might not be as easy against Vestergaard, Kerr and Christensen, that the advantage they had from set plays against Ukraine may not be so relevant. And if you think of the problems the Czechs had, you have a Czechs last 20 minutes just lumping balls in the box, getting nowhere, and their goal came from a low cross, so it might be a day for those Sterling cutbacks rather than high balls.
I think he'll play a four because I think
it'll be a four.
He likes Mason Mount so much that Mason Mount is sort of the only person that can play in that 10 role in the way Southgate wants. And I think if Saka's fit, I think he plays.
So will you play Saka on the right then?
Yes.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. I thought Sancho played well, but I think Saka is more direct.
And more used to playing in a defensive role.
True.
And given how well Joachim Meiler's played, you want somebody who you can guarantee you'll be able to track him well.
Yes. So, I'm nervous about it now. we shall see what happens.
Well, just look at it. I think England will win, but Denmark should pose far more of a threat than Ukraine did. As Johnson says, they have three central defenders who are all good in the air compared to Ukraine, who had one who had to go off in the first half. And their wingers, I think, will offer a lot more threat than Ukraine's did. But, and they've got Kasper Dahlberg and Juuse Poulsen, who are both pretty nifty. Martin Braithwaite, I don't think Braithwaite has he scored yet, but he's a thorn in anyone's side. And Poulsen and Dahlberg are both in form, so I presume one of them will start and one will come on at some point, but should be a decent game.
Absolutely. 60,000 people will be there. Kasper Schmeichel was asked how much he doesn't want it to come home. Was that what it was, Barry?
A journalist asked him if he was familiar with the phrase football's coming home. How much would it mean to you to stop football coming home? And Kasper Schmeichel looked at him with what can only be described as utter contempt and said, I wasn't aware it had come home. Have you won this tournament? And then the journalist explained you know, oh, well, you know, we won the World Cup, whatever. Anyway, or sorry, you know, it came home in 66 and Kasper Schmeichel said, but that was the World Cup. And anyway, yeah, it was kind of toe-curling, but
we'll all be okay, won't we?
Yeah, no, you know, it was just one of those awkward press conference moments.
Okay, well, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. It's almost bedtime, everybody, but that's not for all of you. It's not Jack and Ori, is it? To see all of our listeners just there, duvet over nose, just waiting for me to say they're allowed to go to sleep. Patrick Vieira is the new Crystal Palace manager, 3-year deal. It's a project that's really appealing to me, having spoken a lot with Steve Parish and the sporting director, Dougie Friedman. The idea of Patrick Vieira selling himself to Dougie Friedman is funny. And the plans for the whole club, including the academy. Your thoughts, please, Philippe.
My thoughts, I think that the jury's very much out on, obviously at this point in time, on disappointment. I think people who would be expecting Patrick Vieira to make Crystal Palace play a more expensive game than Roy Hodgson are in for a disappointment if one is to judge by the kind of football that he practiced at Nice when he took over from Lucien Favre, who had a team that was really easy on the eye, a team that was very progressive. And what Vieira did was basically to go back to the nuts and bolts and to create a team that was extremely difficult to beat, which he managed to do. They finished seventh and fifth, I believe, in his first two seasons before the results starting to go the other way in his third year there. It's, in a way, a more conservative choice than you would think in that way, because it's he's proven, I think, with Nice that he managed a team that had very, very limited means, not many options in attack, and he managed to get some very decent results with them. And I guess that's one of the reasons why Crystal Palace went to him. And an important point, by the way, Max, is that Vieira was very much in their thoughts from early on. As soon as they knew that Roy Hodgson would leave the club, he's not somebody whom they turned to because suddenly the agreement they had with Lucien Favre, amazing coincidence, just fell apart. No, he was definitely one of the candidates, the early candidates for the position. But I'm not expecting fireworks at Selhurst Park next season, but it might be more of the same, solidity and staying in the Premier League, which I believe at the time is probably the only thing that Crystal Palace should concentrate on, given the primes they've got with some of their star players.
Arsene Wenger has repeated his call for the World Cup to be played every 2 years as part of a complete overhaul of the international calendar. More knockout matches, fewer qualifying games. That's what the fans want. I mean, I sort of feel like I would prefer a knockout game to a qualifying game. Wenger was speaking to Kicker magazine in Germany. He's proposed a month-long international break in October for nations to play their entire qualifying campaign and then play the finals in a tournament in June. We want to reduce the number of games. That's important because we can see the conditions of the players. The plan would see the number of days in the football calendar reserved for international breaks reduced from 50 to 28, as well as the number of qualifying matches cut from 10 to 7. So does that make any sense then or not?
No.
Okay.
No, it's a terrible idea for all kinds of reasons. But the obvious problem is, okay, that might be great if you support or if you're from a big South American or European nation. But if you're from an African nation, you need the Cup of Nations because that's the thing you have a chance of winning. Or if you're from Asia or if you're from CONCACAF. So, yeah, there's no sense having Ghana turn up at the World Cup every 2 years. And okay, sometimes they might get out of the group, or sometimes they might get to the last 16. But you need the African tournament to develop and promote football within Africa. You need the Asian tournament to develop and promote the sport within Asia.
The crux of the matter is financial. The World Cup represents something like 92% of the income of FIFA. You have twice as many World Cups, you multiplied the resources by two. I did a little poll on Twitter, Max, about that, because they said, you know, it's what the fans want. And so I was wondering what people thought who follow me on Twitter. Most of them are football fans, and still 14 hours left on this poll if you want to vote. At the moment, it's 6,000 votes, and 86.1% of the people who have answered say that every 2 years, no way. So I think that's pretty clear. And I think that's also The Athletic, a correspondent for The Athletic in Japan, did the same thing. And interestingly, the Japanese fans were also vehemently against this proposal. And I'm not aware myself of any study or any polling which has been done at fan level. So it's complete. I mean, I should stop here because I'm going to be beeped out of the program.
Parental advisory. Okay. David Thomas writes, Dear Barry, where he says, Dear Mr. G, I once shat myself on a bus to Krakow. it was an unnerving, unedifying and horrific experience. The sensation that I felt when I knew it was coming. There was nothing I could do. No toilet on board, but it was coming, inexorably coming, is a feeling I will recall with a shudder forever. Finally arrived in Krakow, I jumped off at the first stop and threw myself on the good people of Radio Krakow, who allowed me to use their facilities to organise myself as best I could. This too was a horrifying experience for me, but I'm sure too for them after I had left. I fully and wholeheartedly concur with you, Barry. This is unholy and devastating. David.
It's not that bad. It's just a body. It's a chemical reaction.
Finally, Dr. Cameron Zinsau says, not a question, but a comment. I've been listening to the pod since 2008, and every week since then, everyone has provided the best analysis I could ever have hoped for in a podcast. I will listen until the day the pod dies. Hopefully never. Thanks for everything, everyone. So there we are. That's nice, isn't it? And the pod hopefully won't die before the weekend or before tomorrow when you come to my house, Barry. If it is going to... Are you going to bring a spare pair of trousers tomorrow?
Do I have to bring anything else? A few cans or some a dessert?
I'll supply the booze. Don't you worry. You can't smoke in the house.
You can't invite someone around to your house and then make rules to decrease the amount of fun they're going to have.
You can smoke on the terrace.
Oh, that's fine.
Oh, fine. Okay, that's good. That was easier than I thought it would be. So I'll see you in my house tomorrow.
Do I have to remove my shoes?
Nah, I don't care about that. You put your shoes on the sofa if you want. Well, it depends. We've always got a towel. There are two toilets. We'll all be safe. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, Philippe, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry.
You're welcome.
Lars Sivertsen, Marcus Bean, me and Barry after England-Denmark tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.